You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for coming. Welcome to this event. It is being presented in conjunction with the Congressional Internet Caucus, and its co-chairs, Congressman Bob Goodlatte, Congressman Anna Eshoo on the House side, and on the Senate side, Senator John Thune and Senator Patrick Leahy. The title of the event is The Future of Hacking Disclosures, What Are the New Rules of Engagement? The court case regarding the locked iPhone of the San Bernardino terrorist brought to wide public attention the details of technical issues that are usually relegated to the somewhat limited circles of technology policy professionals, be they in the Bay Area and D.C. and New York City or other tech hotspots. While encryption stole the spotlight, and I'm sure we'll definitely breach that subject, no pun intended. Another important but overlooked issue featured prominently in that case were vulnerabilities. So we're not going to tackle that case in particular, but in order to put some spotlight onto vulnerabilities, we've assembled a fantastic panel of experts, and we're going to delve deep, or as deep as an hour of time can allow, into the topic of vulnerabilities, disclosures, responsibilities of the various stakeholders involved in the process, and the policy framework that should regulate it. So we're going to start off on the far right over there, with this evening, with our special guest, Mr. Kurt Upshaw. He is the Deputy Executive Director and General Counsel of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and it's a bit of a treat to be able to have, an EFF head honcho here. EFF being in San Francisco, us doing most of our events, if not all, in D.C., it's not very usual to be able to have somebody like Mr. Upshaw, so we're very excited to have him. In addition to representing clients on civil liberties, free speech, and privacy law, Mr. Upshaw counsels EFF on EFF projects and initiatives. Before joining EFF, he worked at Perkins Coie, where he represented technology clients with respect to intellectual property, privacy, defamation, and on other online liability matters. He received his law degree from Bold Hall and undergraduate degree from UC Santa Cruz. Take it away.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks to the Congressional Internet Caucus for throwing this event and having me here. I'm very excited to talk to you all about vulnerabilities and some of the issues surrounding disclosures. One of the things I wanted to sort of start with, maybe a little bit of background or overview of what some of the issues are, is when products go out into the market, software products, sometimes hardware products as well, they have very complex systems that will quite frequently have a vulnerability, some aspect of them which is insecure and has the potential to be exploited. So that, for example, it might be that it's a system that is designed only some people can log into it and control it, but yet there's a flaw in the login mechanism so that somebody without credentials can log in and exploit it, or they can get root access to it and use it for whatever they will. And there's a sort of a species of these vulnerabilities known as zero days. The term zero days comes from basically the amount of time that you have to deal with it. When they are first become discovered or known, you have 0 days to deal with it. And then, the following day, there will be a 1 day. They are some of the more challenging vulnerabilities because there will always be a certain period of time between its discovery and its patching when the vulnerability could be turned into an exploit. And I wanted to make a little bit of a distinction there between vulnerabilities and exploits. The vulnerability is a place where there's a weakness in the defenses of a system, but is not necessarily something that can be readily exploited. And then if you study a vulnerability, you might be able to turn it into an exploit, and then with that exploit be able to launch an attack or do prove up that the vulnerability is good. Not all exploits are bad. In some cases, you want to have a proof of concept to show that the vulnerability needs to be taken seriously, to show how it might work to help people understand the defenses. So it's a question of sort of whether the exploit gets into the wild or whether it is used for good or for ill. And then vulnerabilities can be discovered by a wide variety of people. There are, you know, security companies that sort of spend good efforts trying to research them. There are academics who are working in computer security matters that do it as part of their mission. There are private researchers who look for vulnerabilities for fun or for profit. And government agencies will also look for vulnerabilities. And once a vulnerability has been discovered, there are a number of things that you can do with that vulnerability. You can disclose it to the vendor, the person who put the software or the product together or out in the marketplace, so that they may patch it or find a way to render it so the vulnerability can't be exploited. You can disclose it publicly, both to let the vendor and the world know about the vulnerability, and this can be extremely useful for developing the art and science of computer security, as people know what vulnerabilities are. If they have a similar product that might have that problem, can look for ways to fix that. And even if the product is unpatchable, it may be useful for the consumer to know that the product has vulnerabilities and maybe they should stay away until the situation has been resolved. Or you can transfer the vulnerability to a third party. It could be to a government agency who's interested in purchasing the vulnerability. It could be on the black market. It could be selling it to the vendor. But there are markets for vulnerabilities. And then finally, you could decide to keep it secret, either because it doesn't seem worthwhile to send around, or perhaps you want to exploit it yourself. And these are sort of the range of things that someone might do with a vulnerability. And by and large, to enhance our collective security, we want to have the path that leads to the vulnerability being patched. That it is, even if one person has discovered it and they do keep quiet about it, someone else may discover it. And if you have the first person, a white hat, who has discovered it but decides to keep quiet about it, and then the second person discovers it as a black hat and decides to exploit it, then we're just as bad off as if it had been exploitable in the beginning. By getting it out there, getting it to the public, you can take defenses against it. So these lead to some sort of the policy considerations on why or how you might want to report on vulnerabilities. And we can go through these in, I think, greater detail. I don't want to take up all of the time, but sort of very, very generally, there is some trade-offs in disclosure. One with public disclosure is that while it may incentivize a fix and bring attention to it and warn people about a broken product, it also may give the incentive for somebody to go out there and take care of the vulnerability or exploit the vulnerability before it is patched. And this, I guess a related problem is even when something is patched, there's a period of time between when the patch is announced and when the patch is deployed. You know, there's a thing where Microsoft, they like to give out their patches on Tuesday. They call it Patch Tuesday or something like that. And then there's a business of reverse engineering those patches to find exploits on Wednesday because most people don't update their software in time. And so you have, you know, a day to figure out how to exploit it and then can use that exploit until people patch. And there comes to be this notion of responsible disclosure, where the path of responsible disclosure, what is responsible, will be very situationally dependent. But the notion is to tell the vendor what the problem is, give them a reasonable opportunity to fix it and deploy the patch, and then subsequently go public with the vulnerability and showing the world how that had been done, so the world can do a better job at defending standing against it. Though I say sometimes the most responsible thing to do is to go public even before a patch is developed, because the problem is so severe or so unpatchable that it is better to have people stop using the product than wait for the patch to come out. Or there may be evidence that there are other people currently exploiting it, and it's best to let people know rather than wait until it has been fixed. So that's a bit of where I'm coming from on this process, and I guess I'll turn it back to David.
Thank you very much, sir. Now we're going to go to Mr. Geiger. Mr. Harley Geiger is director of public policy at Rapid7, which is a cybersecurity firm. Prior to working there, he was advocacy director and senior counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology between 2014 and 2016. He worked on issues related to surveillance, computer crime, and cybersecurity. Between 2012 and 2014, he was senior legislative counsel for U.S. Representative Zoe Lofgren of California, serving as lead staffer for technology and intellectual property issues. Mr. Geiger is an attorney, and he is a CIPP U.S. Certified. Sir.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for coming. Like David said, Rapid7 is a cybersecurity firm, and we have a variety of cybersecurity products. Some of them include penetration testing products. So for a fee, we will hack your products or your services and tell you where you're vulnerable so that you can patch it and then be more secure. We also work with a lot of independent researchers that can then give us exploits to teach us new ways to hack so that we are keeping up to the state of the art so that when we perform that service I just described, we stay on the cutting edge of what attackers are able to do to you. So hopefully we have a somewhat unique perspective in this game. You had mentioned perhaps not talking too much about the Apple versus FBI case. I actually think we should absolutely go there because I think it is such a great example and is so famous now of where government hacking can sometimes come into play, right? So the iPhone was encrypted. The San Bernardino terrorist iPhone was encrypted. The guy was dead. The government had a very difficult time getting into it via more conventional means. And what did they do ultimately to get into it? They hacked the iPhone. Prior to that, though, there was talk in Capitol Hill of having a backdoor into encryption. There was talk about in the courts about forcing Apple to write custom software to undermine its own security features in order to unlock the phone. From our perspective, a backdoor into encryption and a legal mandate to require companies to write custom software which is essentially malware, to undermine their own security features, these things will not provide the most security for the most people. We think that those are bad routes to take, although we absolutely respect the work that law enforcement does to stop cyber criminals, which is a lot of what we do too. Government hacking, however, is a way around encryption that does not require these same sorts of legal mandates. Government hacking is already happening, so the question of whether it should happen is we're actually way past that point, and it should not be unexpected either. Investigative needs are changing as more crimes take place online, as more of our lives are online, and as data becomes more valuable. It should be expected that law enforcement's tools will also evolve to meet society's needs as well as to match the tactics of criminals. We support an effective and safe judicial system, justice system, and law enforcement. I think that society expects the same as well. But, of course, hacking is fundamentally different from things like traditional wiretaps. With hacking, you need to expect periodic system failures and damage to computers that you are, in fact, hacking, which is often not the case in a lot of other law enforcement investigative techniques. It raises issues of due process, what should be the standard that government needs to meet when they, in fact, decide to hack a system, and what should be the rules that are governing what the law enforcement does with the treasure trove of information that they will encounter on these systems. It also raises a lot of issues about vulnerability disclosure, which, of course, Kurt had just talked about. There is a process that the government has in place to decide, what do we do with the vulnerabilities that we find? So in the case of the Apple versus FBI, Apple versus FBI case, the government had contracted with a third party to perform that hack, and supposedly the government did not get the technical details of the hack. So the government doesn't know how to do it. But if that had been reversed, if the government did know how to hack the iPhone, then it raises the question, should they disclose that hack to Apple, and what should be the process for that? There is a process, but it's not codified in law, and it's not transparent. And we think that those things should change. We think that it should be codified. We think that it should be transparent so that society has a greater understanding and we can have a public discussion about what that criteria ought to be. And then also to minimize the types of damage that I had just described earlier, you know, that is inherent with a lot of hacking, it's going to require a great deal of technical expertise and resources on the part of government, which also means more funding and more attention being paid to this type of activity. So we're in the early stages of the conversation about what the rules ought to be for government hacking, but we think that those rules ought to be clear, and we think that this is the conversation that we should be having. And Rapid7 is committed to working with law enforcement, privacy advocates, and Congress to resolve this issue in a way that serves everyone's needs. Thanks.
Thank you very much, sir. I forgot to mention at the beginning, if you want to tweet about it, we have the hashtag DisclosedHacks. So please go right ahead. Next, we're going to hear from Ms. Susan Hennessy. She is a fellow in National Security and Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. She's the managing editor of Lawfare blog, which is devoted to a sober and serious discussion of hard national security choices. She focuses on national security issues surrounding cybersecurity, surveillance, federal terrorism prosecution, and congressional oversight of in the intelligence community. Prior to joining Brookings, Ms. Hennessy was an attorney in the Office of the General Counsel of the National Security Agency, where she advised operational elements on matters relating to information assurance and cybersecurity and represented the agency on cybersecurity legislation and related executive action. Ms. Hennessy? I think you have to press that.
Okay. Thank you all for being here. So I broadly agree with sort of the framing of lawful hacking as sort of an alternative or a workaround to some of the broader challenges of the encryption debate. I think from what most of us saw with the engagement and the, both the government engagement and also the private sector engagement and privacy advocacy engagement, the appetite for sort of broad performance standards or backdoors or other potentially overbroad mechanisms to regulate encryption have too many unintended consequences and are sort of too problematic. From that discussion, one sort of suggestion that emerged among industry experts as well as within the federal government was this notion of allowing the government to exploit existing vulnerabilities with some mechanisms in place to control that activity. I think the question that's before us now is how do we administer that system in a way that actually allows the government to achieve its baseline functions, and where are the areas in which we need to standardize and formalize a process? So we've mentioned a little bit this question of vulnerabilities equities disclosure. That's the process by which the government assesses whether or not they it's proper for them to retain a vulnerability for a potential exploit or disclose it. I also think it's important to allow the courts to answer some threshold questions. So one of the most important threshold questions that we don't have the answer to yet is what a defendant is entitled to know in a criminal investigation. That really goes to a question of due process. I mean, it's not something that can be modified by Congress. Courts are going to have to decide what the scope of that right looks like. So I think whenever we talk about these issues, it's important to sort of put everything in its appropriate place and to present it to approach it with an understanding of what is the task at hand, what is the job to be done, and then how do we ensure that we're doing that in a way that is true to our values, consistent with our laws. Information security and broader cybersecurity concerns are certainly a core element of that. Privacy concerns are implicated throughout, but it's really important that we have a broader, more holistic conversation about sort of where we all fall on issues that are incredibly important. I think that the stakes here really can't be overstated. These issues tend to come up a lot in sort of terrorism conversations for some reason. I think I'm not sure if it's because that happens to capture people's imaginations, or maybe the government has sort of pushed that narrative. The place in which sort of we are again and again and again seeing these issues actually come up in courts is related to child pornography investigations. And the FBI has been pretty clear from the get-go in their testimony on Capitol Hill that that's really the area in which they're coming up against encryption as a challenge. So one concrete discussion that we've been having, sort of the broader policy community has has been having involves the use of a network investigative technique that the FBI used against a child pornography website. There's a lot of sort of interesting legal questions and sort of heightened discussions. One thing that I think I haven't actually seen reported, although it's a matter of the court record, is that investigation and the question of whether or not the FBI can use that tool going forward, and they need to maintain secrecy in order to do that, not only did it lead to 150 perpetrators caught within the United States, that's separate and apart from globally, it led to charges against 37 hands-on child abusers, 17 producers of child pornography, and most importantly, the FBI was able to rescue 26 child victims who were being subject to ongoing horrific abuse. So I think whenever we sort of have these conversations, it can be really tempting to kind of want to step back or make them really theoretical. The questions here really go to sort of core notions of government function, our obligations to one another, sort of our core values. It's important that we not let sort of emotions overtake our commitment to process. But I also think we really need to be crystal clear and honest and intellectually honest about what the stakes are and what sort of questions are at hand.
Thank you very much. And now we're going to go to Ms. Heather West. She works on security, cybersecurity, data governance, and privacy in the digital age at Mozilla. Mozilla is the maker of the Firefox browser. At the intersection of public policy and technology, she is part policy to tech translator, part product consultant, and part long-term internet strategist. She works with stakeholders, and policymakers in D.C. as well as global product and policy teams, and was recognized as one of the 2014 Forbes 30 Under 30 in law and policy. She helped found the public policy team at Cloudflare, website performance and security company, served as global and federal privacy and security issue expert on Google's policy team, and started her career working on government technology, privacy, and identity management at the Public Interest Group Center for Democracy and Technology. Ms. West?
Thank you. I'm as the last person in this fantastic lineup, I'm left with very little to say. But so Mozilla, as the maker of the browser Firefox, is very invested in user security. And we've been talking a lot here about kind of the government use of vulnerabilities and lawful hacking a little bit. I think, you know, to step back just a little bit, I think industry and companies broadly are very, very interested in acquiring knowledge of vulnerabilities in their products so that they can protect their users. We are hardly unique in that particular space. I think that, you know, from our perspective, it doesn't matter who has that vulnerability, whether it's another company, it's a security researcher, it's the government. You know, we want to know about it and we want to fix it. And that's just, you know, a core value of the technology industry, and I think increasingly across all industries as every industry becomes a technology industry. We have been looking at some of those, you know, vulnerability disclosure processes. I think that, you know, in industry, there's a reasonably well understood set of, you know, practices that most people support for vulnerability disclosure. You know, the NTIA process, kind of formalizing some best practices, is pretty good evidence of that. That's, you know, the point we can look at that and say, okay, this works pretty well. But we've been looking very specifically at some of the ways that the government does or doesn't do that kind of disclosure, and not see. I think there's some transparency issues, but there's also some concerns with how that vulnerability equities process that you mentioned is run. I think that we're thinking about it very much as a way to make the entire internet safer. At the end of the day, if we can fix these problems, then the entire internet is safer, and given the user base that any given popular technology product has, that's a huge impact. And then when you step one step beyond that and you start thinking about the code that really underlies the internet, it's open source, it's not always well maintained, there's, you know, often not been a security audit on that, those vulnerabilities are incredibly impactful. And again, regardless of who figures out that there's a vulnerability, we really want to know about it. We do a lot of work both on our own product and to support the integrity of the infrastructure of the internet via those open source components, both with funding, with research, with collaboration. At the end of the day, fixing these vulnerabilities helps everyone stay safer. It may in fact make law enforcement's life just a little bit harder, but I think that as the technology progresses, we're going to be able to find a good balance that allows transparent, accountable process around the use and disclosure of vulnerabilities from government, from law enforcement. And I think that it's actually an incredibly positive thing that we're starting to have a very robust discussion about what that means. 6 months ago, I was swearing up and down that no one would ever talk about this. I was trying to set expectations for the folks within Mozilla that wanted to be thinking about vulnerability disclosure from the government, that it was going to be really hard to drum up interest. And then we see stuff like the Apple versus FBI case, and we start seeing, these court cases that are using vulnerabilities as an investigatory technique, and we're starting to see discussion, and I think that's an incredibly positive thing. If we can go about it in such a way that we have, we balance all of these interests and create some accountability and transparency, I think that's a win-win.
Fantastic. I think we can, if anybody in the audience has some preliminary questions right now, we can sort of jump back and forth, but if not, we're going to keep the panel here. So we've gotten out the fact that, first of all, vulnerabilities exist, whether we like them or not. They are being discovered and used by private researchers, by companies, by government. The fact that there's some process that is either sort of being talked about or put into place, whether or not it's codified into law, it exists, right? So then my question to the panel, which is just like a beginning question to get the conversation started, is do you think that there's a difference between the responsibility of let's say a government versus the responsibility of a private researcher to disclose this the information of a vulnerability? Just a question to the panel. I think we have one there.
Sure. I want to start out by pointing out that vulnerabilities aren't rare. There are lots and lots of vulnerabilities out there. It takes a little, some time and effort, perhaps, to find one, concerted effort, and they will be found. And so we have like a very, very large problem of many, many insecure devices. Many, many, security is very, very hard. And so any time that a vulnerability is known but is not disclosed in a manner that leads to a patch, if you are trying to think about the betterment of society, you have to think about how long is it going to be before someone else has found this vulnerability who might not be thinking about the betterment of society and might want to use that for ill. This is not limited to government disclosures. I mean, the vulnerability equities process is a way of trying to weigh that out, and it is I agree with Harley that more transparency on that would be very good, to see how well it has been working, whether it has been effective. People I know on security teams of companies, nobody has seemed to have received a vulnerability that has been disclosed through this process, but maybe it's being disclosed in a secret manner. But be that as it may, we have a tremendous problem of many, many vulnerabilities out there that are being found, and there's a lot of incentives for whoever finds it to either exploit or keep it secret. It might be that they're exploiting it because they think that is going to make the world a better place. They're going to fight against scourges, and that seems to be the government's position. And there are other people who will be exploiting it to make the world a worse place, to hack on people, to engage in fraud, identity theft, espionage. And you can't be sure that if you find a vulnerability and you decide you want to exploit it, for even if you think your motives are the best and you're going to save those children, that someone else is not using that same technology to do really awful things. And so that's why it's important to weigh these things. And then, you know, to get to your question, you know, is there a difference as between them, between a private actor and a public actor? Well, you might say that the government is charged with thinking about the greater public interest. We all should, and we hope that people generally do when they're taking the action, but the government may have a special place in thinking about the public interest.
I agree. I think that the government does have a very important public interest piece. One of the things that you said was that vulnerabilities aren't rare, and I think that I have some numbers that actually I think help that. We have something called the SOS Fund. It's the Secure Open Source Fund, and it's a big bucket of money that we spend to audit widespread open source software that has never had a security audit. So far, we've run 3 audits. We just launched this maybe a month ago, and these were kind of soft launch audits. 3 widely used open source kind of both infrastructure and interface pieces of software, 3 libraries, had 43 serious security bugs. And so that is one firm that's not, some concerted hacker, that's just, let's go over the code and see what we find. That is not minor. So I think that context is useful. Now, the SOS Fund also pays to remediate those security issues. And so because of these audits, these 3 pieces of software are in much better shape. And we don't know whether these security vulnerabilities were known to anyone else. But now it doesn't necessarily matter, which I think is the best possible outcome. That said, I don't really care who finds the vulnerability. I want to know about it. I do think that there's, in the technology industry, it's almost a religious fervor around the idea that you should share the vulnerability with the person who can fix it, very similar, ideology that you should fix it and you should fix it as quickly as possible. I think security engineers take that very, very seriously.
So, your question on whether there was a difference in responsibilities versus researchers and government—they have a very similar responsibility. For those of you who are not as closely following the jargon, when we talk about researchers, we're talking about usually white hat hackers, people who are going out and finding security vulnerabilities for one reason or another. And for folks that are doing this for beneficial reasons, Rapid7 actually really strongly supports them. There are so many software security flaws that the companies that produce the software are just not going to find them all. We need to decentralize the number of people who are looking for vulnerabilities. And both researchers and government have a responsibility towards transparency, towards disclosing the vulnerability, because the ultimate goal is to have a secure system and the ultimate goal is patching that vulnerability. Researchers tend to follow a pretty industry standard protocol. This too is not enshrined in law, and maybe it shouldn't be. But most researchers, they will disclose a hack to the company first, like the maker of the software, and then wait some 60 days before disclosing it to the public. And they'll often loop in the U.S. CERT, which is the Computer Emergency Readiness Team. So researchers are undergoing their own process that hopefully leads towards a patch. The government, though, has an extra responsibility, because even though the researcher is doing this hopefully for the betterment of society at large, government is the one that actually has to go and catch the bad guy. They have a responsibility to secure the system, but also to actually nab the child molester or the terrorist. And for that reason, government has this additional process, the vulnerabilities equities process, which is really that fancy jargon just means what factors government weighs before deciding when to disclose. They have a reason to delay because they're using it for their law enforcement operations. So similar level of responsibility, but different. The government has more responsibility. But again, the end goal should be transparency that leads to a patch and a more secure system.
So obviously, technically, the questions are largely the same, but I actually view the government and private actors really differently and the mechanisms, the regulatory mechanisms we might want to use to control. So first, the government has sort of a uniquely compelling interests in this space, also uniquely compelling capacities. But more importantly, whenever we talk about government action, it doesn't really matter these sort of broad responsibilities. We get to decide what the government does and what it doesn't do. So the government should be doing whatever we collectively decide. And so we might decide that we want to create a federal agency that is vulnerability researchers, and all they do is public disclosure. We might decide that there's no set of circumstances in which we want law enforcement or national security community to be retaining vulnerabilities. And that's sort of untethered from sort of broader technical discussions, right? That's just sort of the pure democratic expression. Thus far, it looks like we're coming down somewhere in the middle. The private industry is, I think, a more complex regulatory challenge because it's a marketplace. So you want to find mechanisms to encourage people to find vulnerabilities in a decentralized manner. If you over-regulate that, or if you have laws like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that potentially prohibit beneficial activity, you can disincent behavior that you actually ultimately want. And then you want the marketplace to pay people, right? So bug bounty programs and the various cybersecurity companies that have grown up and developed more sophisticated abilities because of this market. I think whenever you talk about sort of the private sector, you have to look at the places in which those kind of market mechanisms are failing to say, okay, is this a place in which we need to regulate, we need to do something? So the legal gray area of all of this is when you sell something that can be an instrumentality of a crime, what are the obligations? Can you put your head in the sand and pretend? If you know that someone is going to use something for a crime or can be exclusively used for a crime, then you have certain obligations. This whole sort of vulnerabilities or zero-day marketplace, one is international, and two exists in an area in which there's not a ton of clear law. I think the challenge is really how does the government, which is not always the best at regulating technology, how do they engage with sort of that broader market in a way that doesn't make the situation worse overall? I don't have sort of an easy solution, but I think that's a pretty different challenge than sort of how we want to think about whether or not we want the government to disclose.
Thank you very much. So then if we're looking at other ways than simply saying that, it's the responsible thing to do is to disclose it, whether it's a delayed disclosure or whether it's to a particular entity, right, not necessarily to the public. When you're dealing with things like bug bounty programs, right, what is, in your opinion, what would be the best way to handle or to create one of those programs in order to reach the, either the most amount of vulnerabilities or to reach vulnerabilities that are a lot more critical? Or, how would you suggest sort of creating such a program?
First, I should say, in case anyone is not familiar with them, what a bug bounty program is. A bug bounty program is where a vendor says, if you come to us with a vulnerability, we will give you a reward. Sometimes it can be thanks or a T-shirt, but more frequently it is cash money. And so companies like Google and Facebook and Microsoft have bug bounty programs where they reward those who find vulnerabilities, and the rewards go up depending on the sort of complexity of the vulnerability, and actually can get to quite significant amounts. So this provides an incentive for the white hat researcher to disclose to the company through the program, allows the company to set a little bit of the rules of the road and say, you know, if you're going to, you know, like Facebook, for example, ask people to create a test account to find a vulnerability rather than using a live account. And that's, you know, it makes it very useful for researchers to be able to do that. They can fully test it without it having adverse unintended consequences. And one of the effects of a bug bounty program is it gives somebody, you know, probably not nearly as much as they might be able to sell a vulnerability in the black market for, but they can, you know, go home and sleep at night and feel like they did the right thing and still get rewarded for their efforts. So this is something I think very important that industry can do to try to incentivize people to find and disclose the vulnerabilities on their systems, even if they don't put a money figure on it. Having a method, you know, one of the more challenging things for security researchers, they find a vulnerability in a product, and there's no way to contact anybody at the company who's not low-level customer service, who doesn't understand security, because they haven't put that contact mechanism out there. There's not a means by which that vulnerability could be readily disclosed. So I think, yeah, these kinds of programs are very important to have and can provide some valuable incentives. One thing also I just wanted to respond to earlier, you were talking about the challenges with if there is something which is the instrumentality of a crime. And I think that's an extremely difficult thing in the cases of vulnerabilities and exploits, because as Harley was saying, pen testing is actually an important part of security. Pen testing or penetration testing is when the white hats go and use all the tools that might be available to the black hats on a system to find where the holes are, and then help the companies patch it. And if the pen testers don't have access to the full range of tools that are available, then they can't really do their job. And yet these tools, by their nature, are the same tools that are being used to exploit. And so it's very difficult to identify something and say that it only has a negative purpose.
So I would just say that if we're talking about what the best system is for getting the most number of vulnerabilities and critical vulnerabilities, I'm not sure that the answer is straightforward. I think that it's going to depend very much on the entity that we're talking about. Some places don't have the resources to really administer a proper bug bounty program. Some of them can't afford the cash and can only afford hoodies. And then, right, which actually has proven effective to my knowledge. But I also think that, Mozilla has a fantastic initiative, which I'll certainly let Heather talk about, which is going to hopefully get at vulnerabilities that other companies would not be getting at. So I think that there's a variety of methods out there. I think that the important thing actually is to recognize this is already happening, right? Researchers are finding vulnerabilities in increasing numbers. There's more and more researchers, and this is a good thing. We have a major problem with cybersecurity in this country, and researchers are the workforce that are going to help solve it, and to enable them to not only fix cybersecurity more broadly, but to do the thing that they love. There are different ways to do it. One, and Congress has a big role to play here. One is reforming the laws that impact security researchers, especially the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, but also the DMCA, as well as some others. But then we're also seeing some agencies that are taking steps to encourage companies to fix or patch vulnerabilities that they receive from researchers. So, for example, the FDA with medical devices, they recently issued guidance for medical devices after they've already been put out on the market. And if a company following this guidance wants to receive some liability protection, then they need to patch vulnerabilities, have a process in place for patching a vulnerability when a cybersecurity researcher brings the vulnerability to them. So there's a variety of methods. I wouldn't stick to one and just call that one the best. I would try to assess the situation. And I think that, like I said, Congress and you as staffers have a role to play in it as well.
I think that's right. I think, you, Harley and Susan both described this whole process as kind of decentralized research. I think that is key. You need to be coming at it from a bunch of different directions. But yeah, I think that Mozilla and other companies were not the only ones with this, you know, genius idea, to pay people to, you know, with consent, hack other people's stuff, and then go to them with the solution. I think it's also, you know, if we're going to incentivize this space around finding vulnerabilities, we should also talk about, you know, Kurt mentioned you may or may not know the right contact. If you hack Bank of America, and then you're like, wait a second, how do I tell them? That's hard. But that is actually the reason that we have U.S. CERT. You know, CERT does something they call coordinated disclosure, and they do it pretty well. It's their job to figure out who to talk to, and they have the contacts, and they have the network, and they actually are able to go out and find that person. And I think that that is a pretty functional process. One of the things that we've been thinking about is how can we help the federal government, law enforcement, others within government kind of leverage that existing process at the U.S. CERT to make sure that any vulnerabilities get to the right person in a timely manner.
Just to sort of briefly, I tend to focus on sort of the government part of this, and I think by and large the industry is better situated, right? So the government tends to focus on quantity instead of quality and measurable metrics, and I just don't think that they can sort of absorb the various equities at stake. They're actually sort of the government's biggest role, I think, in this particular question is as a participant. So DOD just had the DOD hack the Pentagon, where they actually sort of had their own bug bounty program. You had to submit for a security clearance, but people did it. And that was a resounding success for them. I think sort of the one lurking question is, what is the obligation to develop a patch? A significant number of companies sort of in the industry, I don't want to cartoon the technology industry in one category, but a vocal majority really is hostile to the notion of mandatory patching, that it's not administrable, it's not possible, it's sort of, and so I think the question really becomes disclosure being only one half, that the more important half is what gets done with that disclosure. That's just a complex question.
I have a question from the audience. I don't think we have an extra mic. We weren't given, so just if you could just speak up, and I'm going to point the mic at you. I'll repeat it.
We're here talking about government disclosure of hacks. Wondering what you think the answer is for government disclosure of hacks. Specifically, Harley, for one, mentioned a desire that Congress actually codify the vulnerabilities equities process. And so I guess my general question for the panel is, what do you think an appropriate step would look like? Do you think it should be codified in law? Do you think it should, as the White House claims the process does, heavily lean toward disclosure? And a much more specific question prompted by the Apple case. In that case, the FBI did not disclose the exploit that it had purchased, which I don't believe it's been reported, but I gather was actually a black, literally a little box. They did not purchase the underlying information about the vulnerability that enabled the exploit, and that became their rationale for not disclosing anything to the interagency process to decide whether that exploit should be shared with Apple so they could perhaps reverse engineer it and patch it. FBI Director Comey, for one, has made the point, well, we just spent X amount of money, we don't know the exact amount, but it's gathering the ballpark of $1 million, just to unlock the phone. Are you saying we should have spent even more money to secure the underlying vulnerability? What do you think the government should do or should have to do in that circumstance? Finally, just since it hasn't been mentioned, I will note that there are some folks with an opinion on this, Ari Schwartz and Rob May, formerly CyberSec people at the White House, just published a paper on government's role in vulnerability disclosure, creatively titled Government's Role in Vulnerability Disclosure, and I highly commend it to everyone.
So thank you. So for the people listening on the audio, there were two questions. One, the general one was how should the VEEP look like, and a VEEP, and how and is it like the White House says that it's heavily leaning towards disclosure? And then the more specific question is on the Apple case, the FBI bought just the hack as a sort of like a little black box and not necessarily the underlying technical parts of it, and the idea is that they didn't, Director Comey said that they didn't spend even more money trying to fix it. They just bought the actual thing, so then they can't disclose it to Apple. And what should the government's role be? So,
I would also recommend this Balfour Center paper that sort of explains the process really well and some of the history and makes a series of recommendations. Look, at a broad level, I think it makes a lot of sense to formalize the VEEP. There are benefits to the executive order route. It's less constraining on the government. I think the primary benefit is that it's actually something that could be done. It's impossible to really think about legislation that has a chance of being passed. And so if we're trying to move the ball forward, I think it's important to kind of think about those practical considerations. That said, if I was king, I think the statutory route is a better one. I think that there are a lot of underlying questions about separations of powers and other issues that really Congress should be the body to make this determination. There will be challenges of technical drafting of kind of getting the right level, but I think ultimately the process, to my mind, works well. The government says that they disclose about 91% of the vulnerabilities. Of the remaining 9%, some non-insignificant portion is patched by the vendors, like they discover it separately, and then the rest are retained for national security or law enforcement purposes. To my mind, that seems about right, but there are sort of two questions when designing a VEEP. One, is that the right ratio? Are we comfortable? And are we comfortable that the process has been designed to reach the appropriate ratio? The second is, do you trust the government that it's actually 91%, that whenever they call something a vulnerability, they aren't sort of being cute and leaving out things that they should be processing? That really can only be fixed by transparency. The benefit of statute is that it can't be rescinded by an executive, right? So any executive order, the next executive order can change it. And building those transparency metrics, I think, are really important. We've seen at this point that there's a lot of questions about this process. There shouldn't be, right? That the government, I don't really think, they lack a justification for not bringing more information to the public, especially because I think they're engaging in defensible practices. There are all kinds of ways you might incorporate transparency. I tend to think that the best thing is to put as much information in the public sphere as possible. I'm more suspicious about things like using particular agencies as kind of, DHS likes privacy more than NSA, right? Moving those things around. I'm also pretty skeptical of sort of the PCLOB oversight, that kind of stuff, that it looks good on paper. I have suspicions about how much it actually moves the ball forward. But I think this is an area in which a lot of constructive work can be done and should be done.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good summary. I think that the legislative route is the right one, specifically because it doesn't allow quite as much wiggle room as an executive order. But then, creating that would allow for the reporting and transparency to create some comfort with the process. I think that putting this in law and making it clear, like, what the considerations are undertaken, that there is a presumption of disclosure absent some very compelling reason not to disclose to the company. There's a standard process that's done in a timely manner. There's a lot of things that could be done legislatively. And again, this Schwartz-Kanacki report is fantastic and has some of those same recommendations in them. I think actually, there's a strong case to make sure that DHS has a stronger role in the process. Right now, it's a little bit unclear how engaged they are. You mentioned the 91% number. This is from a claim, which I fully believe, that 91% of vulnerabilities are disclosed. What we don't know is how many vulnerabilities went into the process and which agencies are taking advantage of the process and what was just completely skipped. if we were to make this, a legislative, reform of the VEP, then standardizing that would create a lot more comfort for me when someone says 91%. If in fact that's all of the vulnerabilities held by the government, then, I think that we're in decent shape. That doesn't sound too crazy to me. On the other hand, if that is representative of, two agencies and no one else, then I think that's a little bit more concerning. And I actually, from my perspective, I think that the government is doing itself a disservice by not talking more about, how this process works right now, because it does create some suspicion. On the other hand, I understand that the instinct is not to talk about it, when there's something sensitive in play.
Just to briefly answer your second question, this is whether or not, so my understanding is that the FBI essentially sent the phone to somebody and had forensic analysis tested on it. My personal sense is that sort of in a criminal case, those are the disclosure obligations, that's sort of the right area to make those determinations. There are all sorts of really hard questions that were mooted in that case because he was dead. Eventually, the FBI or other forms of law enforcement are going to have to address the question of, can you use a forensic tool against someone either without having the knowledge or without disclosing the knowledge? Courts are going to have to answer that, and we can't wish away the ultimate answer, right? That really goes to a question of sort of our core rights. But I think that that's the right place to answer them. And I think if a court decides that there's a way that an individual can access a fair trial and be fairly represented, either through SEPA-like mechanisms or sort of other elements, then I don't think that it sort of makes sense to put artificial constraints on that. And I think that that's an area in which the intelligence community or national security community occupies a very different space with very different interests than, for example, the FBI. Honestly, partly because their budgets are dramatically different, and so their ability to sort of develop independent tools and to purchase tools on an exclusive basis are pretty dramatically different.
So to your broad question, what should the vulnerabilities equities process look like? We think that it should look a lot like it does now. But it's missing a couple of components. One is transparency, and the other is that it's not codified. And when we are talking about codification, we are talking about Congress acting, not an executive order. And for the reasons that we've already discussed, we do think that there should continue to be a bias towards disclosure, and which the government says that it is in place now. We would like to see that continue. In terms of what gets weighed, it's a lot of what's already being weighed. I mean, it comes down to what the severity of the vulnerability is, how harmful is it to users, how widespread is it, are other people exploiting it, and then law enforcement's needs. Are there other alternatives that law enforcement can use that will enable it to disclose this particular vulnerability? I think that's what the factors are going to come down to. You can articulate it in different ways, but that's what it will be. With regard to non-disclosure agreements between the government and researchers or folks that are holding vulnerabilities, because we think that there should be a bias towards disclosure, and those types of non-disclosure agreements obviously inhibit that, we think that they should be disfavored. But I would stop short of saying that they should be outlawed.
So I think our panel is in agreement about having more transparency and more oversight. So I agree as well that codifying a bias towards disclosure may be a helpful thing. I mean, I guess only with the better transparency we'll know how helpful that will be. But if we agree that that is the correct bias, then codifying it may make sense. On the question of a purchased exploit, where you're not purchasing the vulnerability, you're just purchasing the exploit itself, it seems to make sense to think about that in the similar terms. If you are weighing the danger of having this vulnerability exist against the benefit of using this exploit, the considerations that you're weighing don't disappear if you just purchase the exploit and not the vulnerability. The public policy interest that you might be thinking about in terms of whether it is a good thing that this exploit is available for purchase and will be available for purchase until it is patched seems to be something that should be weighed when you're considering the process. So if we think that it's a good idea to consider the various equities, we shouldn't pull one aspect of it out of that analysis.
Another question?
Nick Weiserson with Congressman Mike Lindell.
office. So everyone agrees on transparency, which is great. But what is that blog post? You know, if we say that codification is hard, which may or may not be the case, but if we say that at least is somewhat longer term, what does the next blog post from Michael Daniel look like that gives you confidence in the transparency? I mean, I think that's the part I'm not understanding is what specifically is it the number? Like a specific number, if he said there were 6,300 vulnerabilities and 5,200 went this way and 600 went this way or whatever else, is it, what does transparency mean? Because, you know, the sense of it, at the end of the day, the vulnerabilities disclosed are definitely going to be classified as sensitive.
So, I personally would be less interested in the numbers of vulnerabilities that go in and out of the process. I'm more interested in the ratio that gets disclosed, and what the high level criteria are for that the government works through, what the factors are before it decides whether to disclose. Michael Daniel's blog post now is the most up-to-date information we have on that, but that can change, of course, at any time. And transparency around how the process works. The codification hopefully gets us there. But, you know, because we are relying on a blog post and an executive order and in some cases years-old information, we're not sure that that's the most up-to-date description of the process and the factors that the government weighs. To me, those are the most important issues when it comes to transparency.
I think that's right. I think that ratio is really key. I'm interested mostly for academic reasons in what the numbers look like, but I don't think that moves the ball as much in terms of kind of creating that comfort. I think that also elaborating on the process of actual disclosure, what that looks like once that 91% goes through and they say, okay, we're going to disclose this, what happens next? I think, as Kurt has said, there aren't any companies out there who are willing to step up and say, we've gotten a report out of the vet process. You know, we've never gotten something that we know to be out of the vet process, which I hope means that they're just not telling us. But kind of elaborating on what that looks like and giving some comfort that there is a process involved, would be really nice.
So I tend to think it should take the form of, you know, making public the broad criteria. I think a number of threshold definitions have to come forward, sort of putting forward these, because these words tend to be real terms of art. I think that there needs to be sort of, the government needs to lean forward on really explaining what are they talking about. And also be candid about what does not go into this process. The participants in the process, that's actually one of the things that is classified that is inexplicable to me. There are a number of agencies in an interagency process. It's not every agency. It's a set number of agencies. They have representation in the process. That should probably be public because it also allows the public to understand what are the equities, who are thinking about these various things. And then I think sort of in terms of transparency, you know, reporting to the committees, there's nothing that inhibits that right now, right? It's just a matter of congressional interest, but the various committees of jurisdiction. So some sort of not just, you know, percentage metrics, but demonstrable metrics on percentages and potentially the numbers that go in and out, and then allowing for a classified annex, which would allow really far more detailed reporting. I also think sort of whenever you there is just a question of first principles here, and it's really important to understand kind of whether people are on the same page or not in sort of designing this process. If you never believe the government is justified in retaining a vulnerability, it's very hard to understand what this process might look like, right? It's basically impossible. And so transparency metrics that are sort of being animated by discussions based on people who just really don't, or interests that just really don't believe that this is ever a legitimate government function, I think ultimately might end up being damaging. If we agree that there is at least some core government activity that we want to facilitate, even if it creates potential risk to sort of broader information security interests, then I think that we have to just agree that there's certain information that is going to be secret. We agree to that in all kinds of other contexts, military, intelligence, et cetera. We do a good job and a bad job, kind of depending on who you are and what the subject matter is. But I think it's sort of it's important to be sort of intellectually honest whenever we're having this debate about I fall in group A or group B, and then we can fight out the real issues, because I think there's a little bit of a suspicion that some of the asks here in terms of we want more transparency, and I'm representing sort of a government perspective that's not specific to any agency, I think there is a little bit of a suspicion that, oh, you say you just want transparency, but really what you want is to push us as far as possible into full disclosure.
I think we have time for one more question, if there's any from the audience. If not, any closing remarks from the panel, and I think we're slightly out of time.
Well, sure. Some closing remarks. We've talked a lot about the vulnerabilities equities process, and I think that is an important thing to think about. But it's only one part of a larger issue, that we have a tremendous amount of software programs, of hardware that is right now has the vulnerabilities. The vulnerabilities exist whether they're discovered or not. It's just a matter of time before someone gets to them. And to enhance our security moving forward, we need to have a process that tries to identify them and get them fixed as many as possible, as quickly as possible, and should be sort of a high priority to create systems and incentives that will allow security researchers to move forward and do the research. There's some of the things that we're talking about, like the CFAA reform or DMCA reform, that incentives that will allow for disclosure to the companies, things like bug bounty programs and thank yous and other ways of trying to get this marketplace moving towards a disclosure and fixed model. We need the companies to do something with that information once they receive it and get those fixes, get the patches out there, set up systems so that they can be readily patched. And we need to address this problem and get good systems in place sooner rather than later, because we're moving very quickly towards a moment where virtually everything will have an internet capacity, the internet of things, that, you know, where your blender, your toaster, your shoes will have an internet connection and can be a attack point that could get into other aspects of the system without very much efforts into simultaneously making sure that that will be as secure as possible. So this is why, you know, when we're looking at this, it's important to have a bias towards disclosure, both in thinking about a vulnerable equity, but also thinking about what we want to do as a society in order to get help with the massive vulnerability problem that we're facing today.
So also another quick plug for researchers, which is that as Kurt mentioned, we are facing an explosion of software in all of our daily lives. It's happening, but we ain't seen nothing yet. And software security vulnerabilities are not going to be going anywhere. They're going to impact us ever more intimately. And researchers, that is folks that are not necessarily affiliated with government or with particular companies, are the ones who are going to help find these vulnerabilities and plug them so that we are all more safe. But for them to do their jobs and for us to be more safe, we do need to look at some of the laws that chill that very type of research, the CFAA, the DMCA being two of the major ones. That's it. Thank you all very much.
So I would just note sort of one thing that has been missing from the broader conversation about zero-day disclosure, and that's the fact that the vast, vast, vast majority of cybersecurity hacks are known vulnerabilities. Even I think the NSA has gone on record saying that 90% of what they use are known vulnerabilities. So it's a little bit of a question of, yes, these are hard questions people should definitely be engaged on, but there is a preliminary question as well, which is that these vulnerabilities exist and are known in a massive quantity, and we're having a really, really hard time fixing that problem, which would seem to be the more pressing concern. And so just not sort of not only having the conversation about kind of this very small subset while forgetting much larger questions about industry obligation, government obligation in this, you know, much broader context.
I think I really love that we're all kind of in agreement that we can make some positive change here. That is not always the case. I think that there, you know, properly incentivizing the space for security is the key. And this is, you know, talking about the VEP is one piece of that. And if we can get to a space where we are finding the problems and fixing them, you know, faster and better, I think everyone wins, because the reality is that these are technologies that touch everyone's lives every minute of every day.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank our fantastic panel for giving us their expertise on this important issue. Obviously, we only had an hour and a little bit, so we didn't get a chance to talk about a lot of things that are surrounding this very important issue. Thank you very much for coming, and please join me in thanking our panel again. Thank you.